Good afternoon and welcome to Health First. Alan Wishart sitting in for Kathy Hart this week. Got a great show lined up. We'll start the show by talking with Margaret Robinson Rutherford about a very specific type of depression, which is known as PHD, and I'll let her explain that term when we start talking to her because she's the one who came up with it. In the second half, we should be talking with Josephine Johnson about the potential problems and ethics of gene editing. But as always, we'll start with the Health First News.
A new study suggests the deep stages of sleep may give the brain a chance to wash itself free of potentially toxic substances. Researchers found that during deep sleep, the slow wave activity of nerve cells appears to make room for cerebral spinal fluid to rhythmically move in and out of the brain, a process believed to rinse out metabolic waste products. Researcher Laura Lewis, an assistant professor of biomedical engineering at Boston University, says those waste products include beta amyloid, a protein that clumps abnormally in the brains of people with dementia. Lewis stresses, however, that the findings reported in the November 1st issue of Science do not prove that deep sleep helps ward off dementia or other diseases. Parents of babies with type 1 diabetes have to prick their child's skin multiple times a day to check their blood sugar, but researchers may have developed a much easier way to check, a sugar-sensing pacifier. While baby sucks on the pacifier, it collects saliva, tests the sugar levels, and wirelessly sends results to a receiver that a parent caregiver can see. In a proof-of-concept study, researchers had adults with type 1 diabetes use the pacifier before and after a meal. Initial tests showed the device can, in fact, measure changes in saliva sugar levels that corresponded to changes in blood sugar levels. The researchers also designed the pacifier with as few small parts as possible and positioned the sugar-sensing technology on the outside to keep it as far away from the baby's mouth as possible. As the baby sucks on the pacifier, saliva is pumped into a collecting channel. If the latest statistics are any indication, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder is no longer an issue for children only. New research shows over a 10-year period, ADHD rates more than doubled among American adults. However, the rate amongst children remains much higher than in adults. For the study, researchers analyzed data from more than 5 million Kaiser Permanente Northern California patients and found the percentage of adults with a diagnosis of ADHD rose from 0.43% in 2007 to 0.96% in 2016. White adults showed a larger increase, 0.76% to 1.42%, than those in other racial ethnic groups. And finally, when a 7-year-old's tongue got stuck in a juice bottle, one savvy doctor used an old trick to release it. The boy was trying to get the last drop of juice when his tongue created a vacuum and he couldn't get it out of the bottle. When he arrived at the Hanover, Germany hospital, his tongue was swollen and discolored. At first, doctors tried lubricating the tongue and twisting it out of the bottle, but that didn't work. So they next tried putting a thin catheter into the bottle around the boy's tongue, hoping that would release the vacuum. That, too, had no effect. Then one doctor recalled a way he once popped the cork out of a wine bottle when he couldn't find a corkscrew. They attached a syringe to the catheter and forced air into the bottle. That did the trick, and doctors were able to separate the boy from the bottle at last.
Margaret Robinson Rutherford is a clinical psychologist with more than 25 years of experience dealing especially with depression, if you will, as a specialty of hers. And since 2012, she's been doing blogs and podcasts on something that she terms perfectly hidden depression. And now she's written a book about it. Margaret, thank you very much for joining us today.
Hi, Alan. I'm just delighted to be here.
So now, how you've been working on, you call it PhD. Mm-hmm. What does that stand for, and how did you come up with the term?
Sure. Well, I started blogging back in 2012, but in 2014, I sat down in my sunroom, and I thought about, just to write my weekly blog post, right? And I thought about some people that I had seen through the years that really, to me, they presented their depression far differently than people who fit more of the criteria for classic depression. For example, a young woman comes to mind immediately that only told me in the third or fourth session, she said, you know, you remember when I asked you, or you asked me about sexual abuse? And I said, yes. She said, well, I don't know if you really want to know this, but I was raped the week before I went to college, and I never told anyone. Now, Alan, she had this bright smile on her face when she was telling me this. And I just remember looking at her and saying, do you realize you're smiling? And she sort of stopped, and these people don't present being able to express painful emotion. They're completely cut off from it. And so I started thinking about these folks, and I wrote the post, "The Perfectly Hidden Depressed Person, Are You One?" Well, it went viral. And then when it was on the Huffington Post about 2 weeks later, I got hundreds of emails from people. How did you know this is what I was doing? I wanted to hurt myself today, but I'm going to talk to my family. It's this combination of, it has several traits, but one of them is the perfectionism with a just extremely harsh, critical, shameful voice, which keeps people from being able to be vulnerable and talk more about some of the things they're really feeling and experiencing.
How hard, is it harder, in your experience, is it a lot harder for somebody who is a perfectionist to admit or even recognize that they are suffering from depression?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. In fact, I have asked people who've been in front of me who I suspect fit into this, what I call a syndrome of perfectly hidden depression, and I'll say, well, have you ever wondered if you were depressed? Oh, no, I'm not depressed. I have too many blessings to be depressed. My life is wonderful. In fact, one person very poignantly said to me, you know, one night I knew something was wrong, and I looked up depression, and I saw the symptoms of depressed mood, lack of pleasure in anything previously pleasurable, and I felt such shame because my life is so good that I put the criteria away and just said, I can't believe, you know, what is wrong with you? And so, yes, these people have tremendous problems with being able to identify what they're doing. Some people seem to know how they're very carefully hiding. And I would, you know, you may have heard the term high-functioning depression or smiling depression, but there's a huge subset of people who know something's wrong in their gut, but they have no clue what it is because they've been hiding and being perfectionistic and taking lots of responsibility and creating the perfect-looking life for so long that that's the only thing they know to do.
Now, one thing I want to make clear right off the bat, and I think I'm correct on this, not all perfectionists suffer from depression. Some are perfectionists, but they are happy with their life.
Yes. Exactly. Perfectionism in and of itself, you know, is can be a great trait to have. It means I want a perfectionistic neurosurgeon. You know?
Yeah.
Perfectionism is just fine. It is when it's taken overboard and you cannot be vulnerable. Brené Brown's work is so important here with her research on shame and vulnerability. And what she calls wholehearted living, meaning you are on the outside what you are on the inside, what we call in psychology congruence. So I just built upon her work and others and began to think, okay, we really need to become aware, both as people and as therapists and doctors and mental health professionals, that if we see someone who is smiling brightly and says, everything's fine, I'm just a little anxious, I work too hard, I'm, you know, this kind of thing, that we need some alarm bells to go off of, is this person perhaps presenting with perfectly hidden depression rather than, you know, she's just anxious or he's just overworked?
Is it easy in any way for other people to recognize somebody who may have perfectly hidden depression, or is it something where you've just got to kind of say, is everything okay?
That's a, you know, part of classic depression is one, I mean, it is the symptom that has to be there, is depressed mood that is observable and noticed by either the person or the people who care about him or her. So obviously, when someone has these traits and their life just looks gangbusters, you're not going to necessarily ask yourself, well, gosh, is there something wrong? with perfectly hidden depression, of course, what I'm trying to do is raise people's awareness that these people exist. I've worked with them. I've had people come in here and tell me, because they've sought me out because of my writing about it, and they've come in and said, maybe 3, 4, 6 months after I've stopped working with them, when we're ending our work, they'll say, you know, I was actively suicidal when I walked in your door. So I'm hoping that if you know someone who, let's say their mother-in-law died or something bad happened, their husband or wife, whomever, men and women, but their spouse lost their job, and they look and say, yeah, it's really hard. We're doing okay, though. We're going to be all right. And you kind of ask yourself, where's their pain? You know, have I ever seen them cry? Have I ever seen them kind of lose it and maybe get mad or seem afraid? Can more of the vulnerable emotions, can they express them? And if they can't, then I want some flags to go up, both just as people and as mental health professionals, that something may be going on. I had a man who I interviewed. In fact, I had about 60 people volunteer to be interviewed.
Wow.
Anonymously. Mm-hmm. And he said, my psychiatrist gave me a depression inventory when I came in. And I took it, and one of the questions was, do you ever feel hopeless? And he said, I'm not going to admit I feel hopeless. He said, if the question were, would you ever admit that you felt helpless? I would still probably say no, but that would be a clue to someone, hopeless or helpless, that would be a clue to someone that maybe I've got somebody who's hiding their true selves from me.
I would think one of the problems with the perfectionists, though, is a lot of them do express emotions, but a lot of times they sort of direct at themselves, how could I have made a mistake like that? They get angry at themselves and stuff like that, and you might observe that. So again, you may not notice the signs of depression.
And so, oh yeah, they have plenty of shame. Now, they may not let on with other people that they have so much. And again, perfectionism, just like everything else, is on a spectrum. But there's been some wonderful research. In fact, it's out of Canada. It's Dr. Gordon Flett, Dr. Paul Hewitt. They've written extensively and researched extensively perfectionism. And they say that there are three kinds. There are other researchers who back this up. But there's perfectionism that is self-oriented, meaning you expect perfection from yourself. You like to do things extremely well. Mm-hmm. You expect other people to be perfect. That's other-oriented perfectionism. But the most dangerous kind is what they have found to be socially prescribed perfectionism. And what that is when you feel like other people's expectations of you are constantly going up. You're expected to do better and better and better, work harder, work longer, and the pressure is so immense that you can break. I'm sure that we have all known someone, in fact, very tragically so at this point, where we saw them in the grocery store, at church, or at school, or wherever it was, and they looked great. And then we find out that they died by suicide a month later. So there's a lot going on with this that we need to really pay attention to and invite people who struggle with this to say, wow, could I lead a freer life? And I know you can. Mm-hmm. But it does take a lot of courage and a lot of bravery and confronting the rules you've lived by all your life and going back and doing some of that work to connect with emotions that you have long suppressed. So it's careful work, it's tough work, and it's courageous work.
Now, of the three types of perfectionists that you described, I am thinking probably the socially prescribed perfectionist is the one who's most likely to have perfectly hidden depression?
You know, that's a great question. I know that they are certainly the most, again, I know this because Drs. Flett and Hewitt and others have found this to be true through their research, that it is the most dangerous kind of perfectionism. So it stands to reason to me that my concept about perfectly hidden depression and me putting together this syndrome, again, I want to stress it's not a diagnosis. You can't walk into your primary care physician and say, oh, I've got perfectly hidden depression. I need help. It's a syndrome that, again, I came up with, but a term that seems to make a lot of sense to people. But I do think one of the reasons why I'm passionate about this subject is that suicide rates are going up so dramatically, and the same doctors I mentioned before have found high correlations between perfectionism and suicide.
Okay, Margaret, we have to go to a break, but when we come back, we'll talk some more about perfectly hidden depression.